This is the first session of what we'll have is, I don't know if we figured out the exact number, eight or so, three, of a survey of the whole Bible. There's two that were in this last winter program, and at that time I spent much more time on the Hebrew Bible than I did on the New Testament, so I'm going to reverse it this time and spend less time on the Hebrew Bible and more time on the New Testament. So Reed and Linda will be happy people. I'm building this around a survey on the theme of worship, Eucharist, manna, and world hunger. So you already asked the question, if we're going to do anything on World Hunger Day, the whole Bible survey is going to be on world hunger. Also related to spirituality, and last night's sharing, for many of you, you're here at Winter Program as part of a spiritual journey or a human journey of human growth and struggling with life and what reaching your God-given potential means. And I'm going to try to be aware of that, how the Bible has a way of life that really would call us into a fulfillment of our humanity as we are created to be. So I thought of that last night, to be really aware of that and sensitive to that. So if halfway through, if I'm not speaking to that or we're not discussing that, let me know. Okay. Then just a few words about assignments. I'm going to have kind of an A and B. One would be for kind of a minimum and a maximum. And I have printed out here some Bible readings that I'm going to hand out right now. So if you want to just pass these around. And this, most of these, except for some exceptions, they're kind of brief Bible passages, and they would be the minimum. And then on the board, I'll have maximum readings. And what I'd really suggest is to let this time, the 10 weeks at Holden, be a time that is to do what I think is sometimes hard to do when we're out in the busyness of life, and that is to just read long sections of Scripture and let those long sections speak and to get the sweep of the story. So if you would, as a maximum, read the whole Exodus account, Exodus 5, chapter 5 through 16, then add Numbers 11 for next time. Or the minimum would be the passages that are on under here on page, you see where it says page 1. Now, where it says page 1 refers to the page on a pamphlet that you haven't received yet, but you will. So don't worry, you will receive the pamphlet. And then the page numbers in brackets are where you can follow these passages in a book called Cry Justice, edited by Ron Sider, which are simply Bible passages on hunger and justice that are all put together in one book. And we're ordering that book. It's a very inexpensive book, but it isn't in the bookstore yet. Unless there's one or two copies, I don't. It's Cry Justice. It's listed up there at the top.
You started out with saying worship manna and something in the world.
Oh. Eucharist and world hunger. Yeah. This material, when I present it out in the outside world, it's just called Eucharist and World Hunger, and then I sneak a Bible survey on them. So it's Eucharist and World Hunger. During like the next week, if you would listen to at least two of these three tapes, and they're called the Inculturation of the Church. Some say they're just about the best tapes in the Holden Tape Library. In fact, they're the most popular. I think they've sold more than any other tape, except for maybe Mary Schramm's Gifts of Grace.
Yeah,
that's why. And they order them. And If you don't have time to listen to all three, the second and third are the best. I think he gets rolling towards the end of the first. So if you only have time, if you see your time is limited. And these are speeches that Walter Brueggemann, who teaches at Eden Seminary in St. Louis, gave here at a pastor's conference at Holden Village, I think when Gerald Ford or somebody was president. No, Jimmy Carter. So you'll recognize some of the references there to a time now of ancient history. Last time, now if I were teaching a seminary course, I would be laughed for holding this as the textbook. It's put out by the Golden Children's Books, and it's called the Golden Bible Atlas. And what we'll have some on reserve, I think, in the libraries that will that work. And then what this book will do is to give the whole sweep of Bible history. The chapters do a wonderful job. And then what's the other excellent thing, it's a reasonable book for this size of a book, $8.95. And then it's a kind of book you can have your whole life to be a reference and a companion to the Bible. And if ever someday you have family and children, it will be excellent. I think it's going to be a timely, I mean, it's been around for a long time, and it's so well laid out. And the reason I ordered this is Bob, in last year's winter program, at the end of the winter program, read this thing through, and he says, why didn't you assign this? This would have helped so much to read this. So for these first sessions now, it'll be clear. We're going to start with the Exodus, but you might want to read the creation and the patriarchal. So read in this, page 9, at least for now, 9 through 28. And it's easy reading. See how many pictures there are and see the extent of the text. I don't believe when you come to winter program you should just be crammed with all kinds of heavy reading assignments. So this will, and if you've been to seminary or majored in religion in college, I mean, this might be a terrible repetition too. So just use your own judgment if you want to buy the book or use the ones that are in the library. And then anybody that knows me knows this is the most wonderful writing desk, lap writing desk book that is there. I've been using it at Holden for years as a lap writing desk. So is that clear then, basically, about the work? And I don't think it's an overburden, and let me know if it is, okay, because I'm just one of the teachers here. Well, I'm by like a week from today. You know, that would take us through next week. You know, and if I see that we're getting ahead of where we're reading, I'll just add the reading on. Okay. Now, I'm going to begin this. It might seem like a long ways from the Bible, but I think the Bible is so related to this, it's where I'm going to begin. And that is with the whole problem of the worship life of the church. And I'll begin with this story. Once, when I was a pastor in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Roman Catholic Church had their national liturgical conference in Albuquerque, which meant every Roman Catholic diocese in the United States sent delegates to this conference of great liturgical and worship scholars. And one of the speakers was a teacher of liturgy at a Roman Catholic seminary called a liturgical scholar. He had taken a year off and spent the year sneaking around to Roman Catholic churches to attend Mass. And then at the end, now it was the end of his year, and he was back to give a report. And none of the priests in the local parishes knew he was there. He came incognito. And the group there knew he'd been around, so they were very interested in his report. He got up to the podium. He explained what he had done, and he says, "Now, I'm going to summarize the whole situation of the Roman Catholic worship life in one word." And there was a long silence as everybody waited. And then he said the word, "Boring." And I would maybe, from that, ask the question, is there anybody here that has ever been bored in the liturgy of the church? In New Guinea, but never in the United States, right? Just in New Guinea. Did any of you ever say, "Oh, here we are cranking the thing out again"? Yeah, then you get variety, and then people are having to flip through too many pages. Is that the... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have any of your local congregations ever had a fuss over worship? Oh, they're still in the red. This really became a crisis, I think, and when so many things were a crisis in the late 60s and 70s. And it continues, you know, what are we going to do about the worship life? Because especially the youth during those days, if you remember, were very irritated by liturgy. It was boring. And what I remember, some of you might remember these, others you might just enjoy hearing them, what we who were in the leadership of the church did during those years to try to fix it up. And I'll just share some of them. One was the one solution I called was the balloons, guitars, and banners. You know, if only we get this thing contemporary. So we brought in all kinds of guitars, and we just we covered the walls of the church with bright banners, and then occasionally we let balloons go. And then we had a special service, one for kind of the traditional people, and then really early in the morning, because the traditional people also wanted to worship at the traditional time, so the guitar service was put very early in the morning when all the guitar-type people wanted to sleep in. And that's when all the traditional people were up, because they get up earlier, but they still only wanted to come to church at 11. These are some of the problems you have if you've thought of going into seminary in the parish ministry. And so year after year we had guitar services now that we're going to try to make liturgy. And they were very exciting, I remember, for a while. But now I visit congregations now that have a guitar service, and I go to that, and I've found they're tending now to be more almost as deadly. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, that you see, oh, there they are, the guitars again, and you go through this. So another solution was what I call liturgical archaeology. And this was done more by the clergy, and the lay people got to watch. And this was, if only we can dress and move about the altar in the way they did it in the 13th century. Then we'll solve the problem of the worship, because then people can come and be awed by our golden robes and chasubles and the way we march around the altar and hold candles. And so I call this liturgical archaeology. And this was tried. Or probably another very common way was to finally just admit as a congregation that the liturgy is boring. So let's get over with it as fast as possible. Let's not have Holy Communion very often, because that adds more liturgy. But let's just rush through it and then turn the lights down in a spot on the pulpit and let the preacher mount the pulpit, and then we'll have an exciting sermon after we get through the liturgy. fast. I remember my first parish, how to mount that pulpit, and I'd see the real stats, you know, just as I was going up there, and the spot coming on me, and I look out, and it's almost dark out there. It's now they're ready for what we're here for, the magnificent, exciting sermon, you know, and when you blew it, you knew you had really blown it. Now,
what do you call that one?
Oh, I don't have a name for it, except rush through the liturgy to get to the exciting sermon. You can get that down to a shorter title. Okay. Then, now I'm going to, these we've gone through. But I want to share the one that I think in my reading is most common in Lutheran churches today, especially on the West Coast and especially on California, in California. And that is to look out and see what is the most exciting religion-wise in American culture right now, and then drop anything that is traditionally Lutheran and do that. And so you'll find churches that put Lutheran much smaller on their bulletin boards, drop the Lutheran liturgy, and then they copy churches that are really successful. And what these churches really do is having a lot of exciting gospel singing and then an exciting sermon. And do you know what I mean, that this probably is the most prevalent way now to kind of solve the problem of ritual and liturgy? Just give up on any kind of traditional formal liturgy and do what seems to be turning people on right now religion-wise in the American culture.
Are a lot of Lutheran churches doing that now?
I think so. You know, not a lot, but it's becoming more and more common. And you'll even find the names of many Lutheran churches being changed to, or a new congregation being called the community church, and then in real little printing, it's, a congregation of the Lutheran Church in America. You have one in Phoenix, I think it's called the Community of Joy. Do you know
that?
You know, that really does that, and I think does it well, you know, and is really growing.
Is there any of that sort of thing in Puget Sound? I'm not aware of that.
I don't know. The Lutheran magazine, I'll bring a copy, had an excellent article on this.
What's the one at the Gardens? What's it called?
Garden Grove?
Garden Grove Community Churches.
The one in
Seattle
Senior Citizens.
Oh.
Oh,
yeah, it's probably one of the fastest growing churches in the, it's on Ocean Shores. Yeah. Where I'd like to move with this, and that really brings us, I think, to the question of ritual, because like you say, ritual is very important. You know it's important when you try to change it. And I want to ask this question, is our problem with our worship life not that we need to change things or try to find some more exciting way to do it or more interesting way or more popular way, but is our problem really understanding what ritual is and what ritual is to human beings? And then ask some basic questions about ourselves in relation to ritual. And that's where I'd like to lead us in our first. And then we're going to move from that to ask the question we'll raise. We're going to ask that then of the whole Bible and then go into our Bible survey. So that gives you an idea. If you're wondering, why are we doing this? I thought this was a Bible class. What is the word? You said the blue shows better, or the red? Blue. Let's think of the word ritual, because that's... basically, we use that as a negative word. How do we use it in a negative way? Yeah, it's just a bunch of pomp and faldigold, pomp and circumstances, you know.
Well, form and not contest.
Yeah, it's all just form, just formalism.
Old stuff.
Old stuff. What? Dead ritual. Or did you
say habit, no meaning?
All habit, no meaning. Or it's just a ritual. Did you ever say that? It's just a ritual. So part of our task is to, I think, take this word and just find, like some words kind of get ruined, can we redeem this word? And the negative we apply to this word basically is what the word is. And that, I'll explain, I mean, the simplest definition of ritual is something a person or community does over and over and over and over and over. If you want the simplest definition, just say over, 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 comma between each, then that's the definition of ritual. And for your personal life, rituals are wonderful because they save a lot of problems. Like, how many of you decided which shoe to put on first? Or which tooth to start with when you were brushing this morning? I mean, we have these rituals that just take care of it. Think of how, and it's one of the definitions, I think, of a person in a depression. In a deep depression is you get up in the morning and you go back to bed because you can't decide what sock to put on first. Any of you been that depressed? I know I've had times when I open that drawer and then just close it and crawl back in. Because my rituals aren't even working now. But what we're going to be talking about here more is not our personal rituals, but our community rituals. And part of our thinking about the renewal of ritual would not only be for our religious community, but your roommates you might have, or whatever your family is, or if you have a family, to realize the importance of over the years developing rituals. And I think one of the crises of the American family today is that the family has lost a sense of ritual. So you grow up not having an identity of this is what Erlanders do. And it's crazy, but we don't even have to explain it. This is Erlanderish. You know what I mean? And I remember my two brothers and I had a sense of pride, you know, that you could look out of the whole world and say, this is Erlandery. You know, and we do it and we don't have to explain it to anybody. It's us. There you're starting to get a sense of the importance. Rituals then are something, a community, when we're talking about community, simply again, a ritual is something a community does over and over and over and over and over again. And now I'm going to, and if you see Fiddler on the Roof, you just know how important, even if you forget what those rituals mean, they still hold the community together. Remember, was it Tevye that when he was asked, why do we do this, or was it the rabbi? And he sang tradition. And yet you wouldn't say, well, it's just their tradition. You say it's the very thing that holds them together as a Jewish minority community in the Soviet Union or in Russia. And as the. I'm going to pass out a chart. And the reason I did this is that some people in Colorado wanted this, and I promised them that I would do it. So add this to your notes from all the papers you will collect during winter program. This will be A17, paper A17. And I'm going to repeat the basic pattern here on the what the arrows going across. Did everybody get it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm saying they're similar because, you know, a ritual for you is something you all by yourself do over and over again. But it's with our communities where when two people or three people decide to do something over and over again, it really becomes the very thing that ties them together. Yeah. Our individual rituals tend to be either our conveniences or our neuroses. You know. Now, what this chart is going to lead us to see is the difference between what I would call living ritual and dead ritual. And I think if we get it, it can be very helpful. First of all, the arrows going across here just represent a community. And this doesn't have to be like a Christian community. Now, it can be any community on this earth. And this community goes through history. And then a community is a community because it has a certain, and I'm going to use the word spirituality here. And spirituality, I think, is just another way of saying it has a certain way of life. And it has values that inform, or to bring it closer to the word spirituality, it has values that spirit or give breath and life to this way of life. I don't know, spirituality is a hard word to get at, to actually define, but do you get a feeling for, because normally when we see that word, we think it's my prayer life. You know, my spirituality is that time when I take some time out to be spiritual. But do you understand we're using it not as your prayer life, but your whole life as a community lives its life together in the world. That's its spirituality. Now, what a ritual is that I think is living ritual is that this community, and we're going to use some examples and talk about them. This community will take time out from its ordinary life to really do a drama. And in this drama, by using words, actions, movements, which would be dance, words, actions, art, music, bringing all these sensual things together, the community creates a drama. And then the community does that drama. And what the drama does is it pictures the community's spirituality. You're already maybe getting a sense how wonderful ritual could be. It's a time when a community stops and dramatizes its spirituality. And then it moves from that drama back into its daily life. Now, what has happened to that community because it stopped and did this drama? The community has really reincorporated itself into the values, and therefore moves into life from the ritual to live those values even more deeply. And so a living community going through history really would be this kind of hourglass like I have at the bottom of the chart there, moving from life to ritual, life to ritual, life to ritual, each ritual pushing the community to live its life and its values more deeply, and then moving from that life back to the ritual and then being reincorporated in even more deeply into the values and into the spirituality, then to move so it becomes a rhythm on and on as a community moves through history. Now, I'm going to give a few examples of what I think are living, living ritual, or what I call good ritual. One is what we've come to call here the hold and hug, and probably some of you have already done it, this ritual. And now none of you had probably thought of yet that it's a ritual. And I'll explain it, and then I'll ask you if you think this is what really happens, and if you. But at Holden here, I think there's a certain sense, though it's imperfect, there's a certain sense of community, of shared life. And part of that shared life is just appreciating the other people that you're here with most of the time. Okay. And part of a way of stopping in the midst of that to dramatize it is a hug. And then the hug has something about it that kind of reincorporates us into that sense of community. Now, another one way you know the hold and hug is a ritual is because it has unwritten rules. Now, I've probably ruined your hugging now for the rest of the time. I mean, after we've said this, forget it. Promise? There are certain rules. One is certain hugs are inappropriate. One that's inappropriate is the A-frame. And just doesn't carry. It doesn't symbolize what the ritual. Do you know what an A-frame hug is? It's just when your faces are kind of close and then your bodies are like that. And there's also a point at which a hug would be inappropriate that you would know. And that's when a hug would maybe move from what we might call all hugging is sexuality. But we would know what point a hug would move from sexuality to sex. Do you know what I mean by that? And there would be a sense or an unwritten rule when a hug would become inappropriate as a ritual. And so we have a little ritual here, and it's a wonderful ritual, and we should celebrate it. And I'll ask you now, do you see what I mean? Does a simple hug fit into what we've talked about as a ritual? Or am I stretching this totally? Yeah, maybe I just said it, there isn't that much to discuss. Should we just say, we'll go on? Okay. Okay, now I'll bring up another, what I think is a wonderful, wonderful ritual. And by saying wonderful, no, I'm not putting a value of good or bad on it. I'm putting the value of it works. And it does this, this, and this. Okay, then. Now, this is my prejudice, and then you might agree, and you know what I'm going to say, and you might disagree. But I think that as a nation, our society, or our national community, the United States, has a certain way of life and a value system that affects that way of life. And just some of my prejudice would be that this way of life is based on competition, winning, wealth, money, and power connected to money, nationalism, an extreme nationalism, the value of moving into the frontier, even to pushing other people away as you move into a new frontier, the power of brute force and strength as being lifted up as a way to solve problems. And then the exploitation of women, seeing women as objects. Now, if this is somewhat of a spirituality and some of the values that inform our spirituality, I'll ask you this question. One afternoon a year, this spirituality is put packed into a powerful drama at which time the nation stops. And it's a Sunday afternoon. I'll give you some more hints. It's in January, and a Sunday afternoon, and it's so important that the inauguration of the President of the United States will be postponed if it conflicts with this ritual. Does anybody know, have any idea what I'm talking about? Right. Have any of you ever thought of the whole Super Bowl, not just the game, but the whole event? Did any of you see it this year? Yeah, to do something.
When people got together, they don't watch it anyway. Oh. I mean, you might as well just sit home and watch it alone in your room.
Mm-hmm.
Because people don't watch the Super Bowl, really.
But that's part of it. That's part
right.
of it.
Right.
They know what is community service.
I was... I've always known that my brother and his family have a lot of ritual around this event, and I was there this year in Colorado for it. You know, I never dreamed I'd ever be there. You know, the same families are together. They serve the same refreshments. It was very interesting, and this was right after we'd done this ritual stuff. So it was. But did you see? If you saw the halftime this year, it was a magnificent religious event, because one of the main things that a religious community does in its ritual drama is to retell the story of the past glory of the community, the past wonderful events of the community, and the halftime was that. We had some of the greatest events of American history portrayed. And then the final scene is firecrackers were going off and balloons and all kinds of colors and great displays of color and band, and this black person who had made it stood up on top of this tremendous something and sang this song, and the final words were, "Your dreams will come true if you believe in yourself." And then and I just kept saying it over. That's what it said. Your dreams will come true if you believe in yourself. Then it was back to the second half. But what I'm saying, it's good ritual. Because I think a nation, by participating in the whole event, really is reincorporated into a certain spirituality. I always want to say before I say this that I think sports have a place in a society, and I'm not being anti-sport. Is that clear? My ping pong partner, who's do you think I'm fair, being fair, that this is a ritual? Like, take one, I'll just ask you some of the things. Where would brute power be dramatized? Brute power. Where would the exploitation of women be? The TV camera just loves to zero in on. And then wealth. What? I found the group I was watching it with, that topic came up often during the game. Wow, the winners get $36,000, the losers get $18,000. Or do you know how much it costs for a second to advertise? Well, I don't want to belabor it, but it helps us see you know, how I think ritual works, and it's living ritual because it really works in our country. And the fact that if you go out on the streets during Super Bowl, they're empty. You know, that it's, the attendance is good. It's up. Now, move this into the religious, I don't like to say religious sphere, but into a specifically religious community. The word, sometimes it helps to see another religious community. The word Islam means submission. And the word Muslim means one who submits. So simply the identity of the Islamic community, it is the people who submit themselves to God. And have you ever seen Muslims at prayer? Yeah, what is the body language? Yeah, you're curled up, you're on the ground, your head is forehead touching the ground. It's the body position of before an ancient monarch, of total submission to the authority of that monarch. And at prayer time, when a Muslim does that, every body movement and plus the words all go together. And then when the Muslim will stand up from that time, do you see how one would be reincorporated into the Islamic spirituality? Okay, now if we reverse these things, we really get a picture of what happens to ritual when it dies. If here at Holden, something terrible happened to tear our community apart. I mean, there are all kinds of little things, so there are problems. But what if something happened so we just hate, we had to stay here, but we just hated each other? And there was division, and there was anger, and there was unresolved, totally unresolved conflict and hatred and tension. What? Right. Okay, now I'll ask this question. What if that happened, but yet there was a law here that you had to hug every 15 minutes? You know, and the bell would ring, and now I got to find somebody and do it. Yeah. Now, okay, then ask the same question of our nation. You know, what if our nation turned into this Gandhian society of cooperation and equality and tenderness and nonviolence? And at the same time, there was written into our Constitution that you had to do the Super Bowl and do it exactly the way it's done now. And you had to watch it or you had to go. Do you get a feeling of what we would mean by dead ritual? Now, I want to go back to the question of the liturgy of the church. And this is where I'm going to move now during all the sessions, that the Eucharist, which when we talk about the ritual of the church, we're talking about the Eucharist, the Holy Communion. Every other ritual the church does either relates to the Eucharist or is supplementary to the Eucharist, to the Holy Communion. And the question I'm going to raise is, does the Eucharist in itself dramatize a spirituality? And then is the problem with our boredom with the Eucharist mainly the fact that most of us live out there in a world that lives a totally different spirituality, and then when we come and have to do this, there's something about it that just does not fit? So that's, if you just hold that question, we're going to after hours and hours on the Bible, we're going to come back and ask the question again. Now to move back to the Bible, I'm going to give you what is, I think, the thesis of these sessions that we're going to share together, and it would be this in this space. It's the basic question. You know, I think I'm raising, is the ritual out of whack or is life out of whack? With the ritual. Because you'll find that communities that are really doing living ritual will probably spend very little time saying, no, I have to understand this. It just is, you know. And the ritual has something that's so living about it, it just does its work without even the question, you know, even the question of, you know, like, for example, the Super Bowl, nobody asks the question, well, I really have to understand what's going on here for it to mean something to me. It just, do you know what I'm...
It's okay even if you don't understand all the plays or whatever.
You know, there's...
I think one problem I'm having with this whole talk about the Super Bowl is you listed a bunch of things that this typifies in our society, but at the same time you're not also saying that that's necessarily good.
No, I said it's good ritual.
Okay.
Yeah. You know. I'm not saying it's necessary.
It exemplifies ritual. Yeah. Necessarily good versus bad.
Mm-hmm. Or another way to say it, it's ritual that works.
For our society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're mm-hmm. saying it as a consensus of ritual rather than from a standpoint of morality.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting how rituals die, because I think in the past in our nation, probably the inauguration of the president was a great time of national renewal. This was time when the whole nation stopped and renewed itself. And now this year, the inauguration got pushed to another day. And who cared?
I don't know if I dare say this, but I've been wanting to say that I've been in churches now. This may apply other places where there is no joy.
The weather was partly to blame, but So that's clear that I'm not making a. I'm just saying if these are our values of our nation, then, I mean, you don't. A lot of people wouldn't even agree with me. Some people would say this is just a big fun afternoon. You're putting a little too much baggage onto it. But I'm not making a moral judgment. I'm just using it as an example. Okay. And also tell you what maybe where we'll start our discussion next time. But we're going to go to a nation now. Called Egypt. And you might wonder. Okay, first of all, the reason we're going to plunge into the whole Bible now is to plunge in with the question, you know, does the Bible teach a way of life for a community to live that community then will ritualize? Does the Bible teach a spirituality or a way of life? And we're going to start in Egypt, rather than with the creation stories. And I'll quickly give you the reason for it. You know, the Bible starts with the creation stories, and then it goes to the Abraham stories, Abraham and Sarah stories, and then the Abraham, and then moves to the Joseph stories, and then moves to the Egypt, to the Egypt story. And this includes the Exodus. And we're going to start here because this is probably in the Hebrew Bible the what's called the primal story, or the entire Hebrew Bible is built around this story. So everything that follows it looks back to it. These stories were added later to just tell how the community moved towards this story. So we're going to start there, and then later we'll talk about how these, what went before it, why later in the community it was important to add these stories to the beginning. And I'm just going to draw what's called a triangle that one of the teachers that came to Holden here really helped me with. But this is the way he showed. This is Paul Hansen, who teaches at Old Testament at Harvard. And I've changed this a little, but basically this is how Egyptian society was set up. First of all, on the very top, you had the Egyptian divinities, or the Egyptian divinity. Then on the top of a pyramid, I don't know, that's just an accident. We'll use a pyramid to talk about Egypt. Top of the pyramid, we have Pharaoh, the big boss. And then under Pharaoh, you have the royal family. And under the royal family, you have what I just call various big deals. You know, these are the big administrators, the big nobility. Bureaucrats, what?
Nobility.
The nobility. You know, these are the big deals. And in the Joseph story, this was a wonderful thing that Joseph sold into slavery and worked himself up to being a big deal in Egypt. And under here, you have kind of the ordinary Egyptian citizens. And then down here you have the slaves. And then you have the priests of the Egyptian gods. And what the function of the priests is to always spiritually let everybody know that this is the way it always shall be, because this is divinely ordained. Priests serve a wonderful, wonderful function in this kind of a society, to always convince everybody that this is the way it always shall be, because this is the way God wills, and therefore nothing can ever change. So this is Egyptian hierarchy, and it's a way that a community of people lives. In a way, it's a spirituality. Everything is neatly ordered and set up. And if you're on the top, it was ordained that way. If you're on the bottom, it was ordained that way. This is the way it functions, and this is the way it works. And the story begins that some of these slaves down here are called Hebrews. Some are called Hebrews. And the basic story of the Bible is the story of God. And the story of a strange, humorous feeling God that doesn't like this. If you want the whole Bible summarized, it's the God that is vexed by this kind of a system. And then it has a little doorway here down in the bottom where the God of the Bible enters and starts subverting the system from the bottom. Now, It's time to quit today, and we can start here next time. In order to get the Bible into the focus of life at all times in our life today, at the beginning next time we're going to break up into little groups, and this is what I wanted to do at the end today, and we ran out of time, and just talk about how does life today in our world, all the way from our relationships of men and women, humans and animals, society, the world, how does it fit into this type of a system? And we'll try to think of different ways where it is. I mean, certainly in the United States, we don't live in an Egypt system with a pharaoh who has priests and slaves at the bottom, but does it fit? Oh yeah, and that, yeah. And then also look at does this kind of a system ever happen in the church? Certainly not. But it'd be fun right now to start talking about it, but it's time to quit. I mean, has there ever been a time in the church when you have clergy up here and lay people down here? No, certainly not. Or have you worked yourself up to by now?
I think I'm a big deal.
You've gotten up to a big deal.
Not real sure. I'm not quite a real fan yet.
And where we'll move is the spiritual struggle of entering into the biblical world as a person today is always to look here to find that little doorway.